Blog Talk Radio.
We've been waiting for a long time. Yes, we've been waiting for a long time. We've been waiting for a long time. But we ain't gonna wait no more. We're getting ready to rock and roll. We're gonna 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3. Well, there's the reason everybody should be shaking in the house tonight. And you should wear your baby lady and promise her you do it right.
Welcome to this latest edition of the Cyril Quinn Review, this special NBA wrap-up edition of the review on this Saturday, June 22nd, 2013. We're going for the next 2 hours as we have some long-winded people joining me, but we're going to have some fun, break down the NBA season, the NBA Finals, and get a little sneak peek at what the next season may come. As always, the call number is 347-215-6180, and I'm joined by one or two, Robert Sapp and Chad Quinn. Fellas, what's going on?
How are you, sir?
Not much.
So we get the repeat from Miami, two championships in 3 years. First, what will you guys overall take on the finals in general?
I'll let my distinguished colleague go first this time.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
I thought the overall play of the finals was really, really good. It was a pleasure to watch like two really good teams. I don't know if I'll go great, but watch two really good, well-coached teams go at it. I know a lot of the focus is going to be on LeBron, deservedly so. But I'm gonna take a little bit of a different take on it for the first part of my commentary. I thought that the way that the media attention on LeBron James was a bit unfair. And I watched, of course, a lot of different sports shows. And one of the main commentaries was LeBron's not doing enough or LeBron's doing enough. And that kind of like was the whole kind of tone of the series. And it just amazed me that LeBron James came to Miami to play with one great player, one good player. And both of those players, Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh, were also $100+ million players. And when it broke down, when you broke it down, when I was reading a column yesterday, when Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh and LeBron James were on the floor, it was something like a minus 56, some ridiculous number like that. And like when LeBron was playing with the Mike Miller, Ray Allen, Shane Battier combination, it was a plus 26. And so I think that's really telling in the way in which LeBron James was the centerpiece and how, not ineffective, but kind of so, that when all three of the big three, so-called, were on the floor, how limited the offense was. And so one could almost say that LeBron James overcame Wade and Bosh's, particularly their offensive inefficiencies. And so I say that to say that LeBron James, going back to LeBron James, was great. He was great. And I think all too often, like a lot of people attack his offensive efficiency and whether he was taking the ball to the hole or whether he was being aggressive. But when I looked at LeBron James and I looked at how this series played down, it boiled down to LeBron James on Tony Parker. When LeBron was on Tony Parker, that offense stopped. It stopped. And it was, I mean, you think about the Spurs, and the Spurs, very good team, move the ball, find the open man, find the best shot. When LeBron James was on Tony Parker, they were ineffective for San Antonio. To the point where you saw in the last game, Gary Neal was driving the basket and Danny Green was driving the basket and were completely out of sync. And so I looked at the defensive effort as LeBron James did as probably one of the biggest keys to this series. I mean, even when he is not super aggressive offensively, his defensive presence changes the game, and his defensive presence in this series changed the game. I felt really bad for Tim Duncan just because, man, he balled out in game six. I mean, he laid it all out on the line. And for that team to lose it like that, and we can get into it a little bit later on what I think about how Popovich coached that particular game, particularly those final 2 minutes or so. It was a tough loss to swallow. I think the series turned. I mean, that of course was a key moment. I didn't know how San Antonio was going to be able to win that game, considering that they went into overtime and their players who were hurt and hobbled and old had to play serious minutes into overtime. But I told Chad this. I thought at the beginning of this series that the Spurs would win in seven. But when that hamstring injury came to Tony Parker, when he got that hamstring injury, I think that's where this series turned, because as we saw in game six and game seven, in the final crucial minutes, Tony Parker wasn't able to be on the floor. And so I think overall you just have to give it up to the Miami Heat, in particular LeBron James, what he did on the defensive end first, and then, of course, how he was able to explode in the end of game six and then just completely dominate game seven. All right. Chad, it is yours.
It's on you, Mr. Quinn.
Yep. And to the viewing audience, I'll try not to be as long-winded.
Well, nobody's watching.
Counterparts.
Yeah, listening.
Well, I feel like when you're listening, you're watching me, because I paint vivid stories. But whoever out there in radio land.
Well, we actually do have a caller on the line, but that's fine. Go ahead.
Please don't answer that.
I'm not going to.
Okay. No, but Rob started it, but I'll go a step further. He said two good teams. I'll say two great teams. I think the thing that comes to mind is living up to the billing. You know, Miami versus Spurs, and this is the championship we thought we were going to see a year before, you know, until OKC surprised everybody. And the thing we didn't know was what version of the Spurs. You know, a lot of times we look at history and we see the teams match up, and then there's an asterisk because the best players are on their way out or they couldn't get it done or injuries. And, you know, to what Rob was saying, I mean, that was vintage Tim Duncan. You know, that was Tim Duncan at his best in years. And so we got a chance to see that. I think the series was just like game six, was unpredictable. Surreal, I remember talking to you, and you texted me, like, I just don't know. Because every time, and it's so funny watching the analysts and the media, because every game, the other team blew it, and the series was over. Like, they had an answer every time the Spurs would win or Miami would win. Like, oh, this is it. They turned the corner. And it was just so much back and forth. From game one, where Tony Parker hits that crazy, ridiculous shot off the ground, you know, yeah, that set the stage for a lot of craziness. you know, to Danny Green possibly being the MVP for a minute, to seeing, you know, Kawhi Leonard, his emergence. There were so many, to LeBron's block on Splitter, to his block on Duncan, to his seeming regression during the first half of the series, to Wade crawling on his knees to get the ball. There were so many moments in this finals. I don't know how many articles I read, and they were like, where's game eight? So to a basketball purist, this is just great entertainment. You know, I know there are a lot of people who, you know, don't like LeBron. You know, we all know this going into the series. No one wanted to see the Spurs. They're boring was the label they had for so many years. And I think that label's been, you know, released the last few years. But it was just great basketball. Questionable coaching at times, and everyone not living up to the moment every once in a while. But overall, it was great basketball. It was legacy basketball. This is the first time that I can remember seeing someone lose and still adding to their legacy.
Yeah.
You know, the way Tim Duncan played, it's like he didn't lose. I've never been a Tim Duncan. I've been a fan of his game, but never been a fan of Tim Duncan. And I actually felt bad for him losing. You know, he doesn't show emotions. When Tim Duncan slams the ground on the basketball court, that's like, I mean, that's like he had a mohawk on or something. Like, you just don't see this type of reaction. And to see how bad he wanted it. But also just to see, I don't even know if this is the right word to use for LeBron, but his emergence. I felt like, and I talked to Rob about this briefly, the first time around when he won, he enjoyed it, but it was still, he was on his apologetic tour. You know, even when he started his speech last year, he knew he didn't do some things right, you know. And it seems like, you know, he said all the right things. It was a very PC, and I believe he meant it, but it was a very PC championship. Whereas this was the complete inverse. You know, whatever about everybody else, this is my team. And the media is going to talk. And it's true, because even as Rob started, he said the media's, over-capturing LeBron's and sensationalizing his story. But within Rob's talk, he kept bringing up LeBron. And it's something that we can't get away from. You just can't get away from the dude, because he's like a walking gift. He gives you so many good moments for the people that, you know, argue for him, but he also gives the haters so much fuel, too, because even in that fourth quarter in game six when he took over, he had two big, huge turnovers at the last second. You know, so it's like he just, you don't know what you're going to get watching him. But ultimately, the best team did win. You know, it was a little sad seeing that Tony Parker couldn't come through at the end, and you know, he was giving it his all, just like the rest of the Spurs. But I think, honestly, it really comes down to game six.
Was it the best team, or was it just the best player?
Well, ultimately, that's the question.
I'm just posing it out there. I'm just putting it out there.
Right. Okay, so let's answer that real quick. And, you know, Thoreau, we and you talked about this briefly in the middle of the series. I said the way I defined the series was talent versus discipline. I think it's hard to say who is the best team because the asterisk is who showed up, right? I think that the Miami Heat have the best talent if Wade and Bosh are playing. But I think discipline is a lot more consistent than talent. Like, talent, you can hit more home runs. With discipline, you can get on base more. And I think that's what the Spurs are. You know, they are a very disciplined team and definitely not more talented when everybody thought they was. You saw as soon as, hey, you know what? Let's try to deal Danny Green. Let's not leave him open. Before Danny Green couldn't move. Okay, so anybody who was thinking for a minute that Spurs match up talent-wise, with Miami, they're losing it. They don't. They have a disciplined system. They are, as we all know, the Patriots. You know, Popovich, he's one of the best coaches ever. So, you know, we'll get to that. But he's one of the best coaches ever. So he takes a whole bunch. He looks at their budget. He says, okay, I need somebody who doesn't talk a lot. As you see why Steve Jackson was never there anymore. I need someone who's going to listen. I need someone cheap who's hungry. So what does he do? He goes to the D-League and gets about five players every year. He goes to the D-League, gets these players, he signs them for 2 years, then he makes them assistant coaches. And, you know, and they come out there and they're hungry. And that, I think that in itself is why they always have the energy of college players. Because these dudes are like 10-day contract type of dudes, not even trying to exaggerate it. This is what he brings into his organization. So he knows that, okay, I can't win with just blue-collar people. He has the foundation with the Tony Parker and Tim Duncan and Ginobili on his way out, and he builds around that. So in a sense, it's kind of like Miami. They have more talent, but they are a B-rated version of the Spurs as far as the role player and fits. And I do think that it's time to really move past the whole big three notion, you yeah. know, because I
Thank
think
you.
It is a notion.
Thank you. Thank you.
You know,
it's very much a notion.
I mean, now what I'm saying is a notion in this day and age. There was a time when the Spurs were a big three, you know, and that's with Ginobili, Duncan. But this whole Miami thing, I mean, I talked to my dad about this. He's like, Miami played the best game they could play. I said, do you understand Chris Bosh did not score? Like, score. I mean, you could talk about Shane Battier and role players, but Bosh didn't score 1 point. And the reason I say we get rid of the big three notion is for that exact fact. Because if Wade did score, if LeBron had had zero, if LeBron had had 0 points, man.
So that's why he retired.
He would have had to. He would have had to go in hiding. He would have had to go in hiding. So that's my whole thing. It's like you know. I know we'll get back to all the other questions, but no, it was just a really joy to watch. And I think you may want to talk about the best championships ever. But you know, this is one thing I have to digest, sit back, and say, man, I honestly could not wait for every game. And even the blowout games weren't blowouts the whole way. It's like something
right.
happened in the second half.
Great point.
Someone got hot.
Great point.
You know, and went crazy in the second half. I'm like, man, this is basketball at its finest. I mean, it's game seven. It doesn't get any bigger than that. You have game seven, LeBron, Duncan, Popovich. I'm still not quite ready to put Spoelstra there, and I have my own issues with that. But he's still a good coach. Not saying he's not a good coach.
I think he's an elite coach. And I'll tell you,
I want to answer Cyril's question about is Miami the better team? I'm going to say yes, and this is the reason why I'm going to say yes. As much as I jumped on Dwayne Wade and I jumped on Chris Bosh, and I think they do need to be jumped on just because, like, they weren't pulling their weight this entire finals. You know, like I said, there are certain points in times where LeBron James and the Miami Heat looked better when Wade and Bosh were on the bench. But with that being said, and why I say they were a complete team in terms of offensively and defensively. And I can't say enough about the Miami Heat's defense, particularly when they wanted to take it up another level. I mean, we saw it definitively in Game 7 with Indianapolis Indiana.
I know we saw it in Indianapolis. Let me stop you there. Was it? Again, I'm getting back to that team versus individual because you jumped all over it with LeBron on Tony Parker. Was it Miami's defense or was it LeBron's defense?
LeBron's the key to everything. So that I mean, like I
no,
don't
I'm
think
just saying,
you can
I'm just saying,
you can't
you, when you put the
you can't break
defense,
you can't break them you can't break them down that and like take the two apart. But I know. Particularly like when I look at game 6 and that last like 8 minutes, like Miami just, they can just ratchet it up defensively. And, you know, for Dwayne Wade, you know, as ineffective as he can be on offense sometimes, when his athleticism lends to kind of like that hype, like I was reading an article in Grantland, it just called it that hyperactive defense, like where they're just like all over the floor. Chris Bosh saying, I guarantee you Danny Green won't be open. And boy, did that Danny Green prediction come true. They were all over him. He couldn't do anything. And so it wasn't just LeBron James stopping Tony Parker. It was literally like them taking away all other players outside of Kawhi Leonard, who definitely did show up and is up and coming. But Miami defensively has a different gear than every other team.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I thought this series, I thought probably pound for pound, the series was the best seven-game series I've ever seen in the finals. And to put that in perspective, there have only been, since 88, five finals that went to seven games. You had the 88 Lakers. But that wasn't, this series blows that series away, let's be honest. It's one of the ugliest series. But anyway.
That was one of the best series. Anyway, go ahead. I won't argue with you.
It was a great point by Elijah Wan. But you had the 88 Lakers with the seven, and that was a class. That obviously could rival this one because that was Detroit on its way up, and that was a Lakers' last, Magic's last championship. Lakers weren't even supposed to win that. So that was definitely a classic series with all kinds of Hall of Famers. I probably would argue that one to be near or probably even better than this one. But 88 Lakers, you had, I thought, the 93 series against Phoenix and Chicago was a classic, even though it didn't go seven games, because Barkley and Jordan were at their best, 3-0, then 3-2, then Phoenix had a chance to win it in game six, that taxing shot. You had, then I would say, then you had, didn't get a game seven until Knicks Rockets game seven. Then you get game seven 2005, Detroit, San Antonio. That was not a great series. That was great. That was a great defensive series, but that was not a great series to watch. And then, of course, you had a classic with the Lakers and Celtics, which, even though as a Laker fan, it was beautiful, it was just the fact that it was Lakers and Celtics going seven games. You really didn't have
it. Yeah, the name was bigger
Game seven actually was a classic, considering the Lakers' comeback. I thought they were dead in that game. So game seven of the Lakers was a classic. But that series was, a good, very good series. But I think this one was better. This one was better because you had the classic game one. You had even in the games 2 through 4, where or 2 through 5, where they were blowouts in terms of the final score, the swings, the storylines, the LeBron's passive, Danny Green, MVP, Duncan. I mean, Ginobili. Where's Ginobili at? Then you
Where's
had
Dwayne
the all-time
Wade
clutch. So where, yeah, exactly. Where's Dwayne Wade? Where's Dwayne Wade at? Then you had the all-time classic games of all time, one of the classic games of all time in playoff history with game six. And then game seven, see, and I told Rob this. I said, man, I'm not even excited for game seven. He's like, what? I'm like, dude, it's anticlimactic. It's over. The Spurs are 90-88 with Duncan with a layup. So that game seven wasn't like that game seven after the first quarter. The game was a great game. If you look at it after the first quarter, it was 18-16. But after that, the teams were scoring on the high level. It was a high level game after the first quarter. So to me, that makes it. I heard Bob Ryan say, well, three blowouts, not a classic, blah, 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 blah. Well, I ain't been around since 1932, so maybe I'll go back to Russell and, Russell and Elgin Baylor. But, this was a great, great basketball series, considering what could have been, what could have happened. What if Ray Allen doesn't make that shot? What if Ginobili or Kawhi Leonard make a free throw? What if Greg Popovich had Tim Duncan on the floor? What the difference in outcomes, the fine line between a team's legacy of being a possible dynasty versus being a disaster was razor thin. And that just added to this series. And it was a great, great basketball series. And I walk away with a couple of players not getting not getting their just due. Because, of course, we talk about the superstars, and rightfully so, LeBron, Duncan, Parker's hamstring. But I'll take one player from each team. Kawhi Leonard. I don't know what the difference between Kawhi Leonard and Paul George is to me. But I think they're basically, maybe George is a better creator off the dribble, but to me, they're like, those two guys are like two budding superstars on the rise. They have a chance to be superstars and star players. Like those, Kawhi Leonard, to be a 21-year-old second-year player, okay, and to be asked to guard LeBron, and then to go on the road in games 6 and 7 and be 22-10 and 19-16, I mean, like that, that to me, that jumped out. I mean, we're watching LeBron, but that to me, he was unreal. He was unreal. Yeah. And again, spent a lot of series guarding LeBron and probably guarded LeBron better. Well, I shouldn't say that because Boris Diaw, that was more mental than anything. Boris Diaw shouldn't be able to guard LeBron. But when LeBron was in tune, he guarded LeBron better than anybody. And I like his performance. If you want to talk about a future of the franchise, it's Kawhi Leonard for the Spurs. For the Heat, Mario Chalmers. Mario Chalmers. And again, nobody talked about Mario Chalmers after Game 7 for whatever reason. Mario Chalmers had 3 excellent games in this series, Game 2, Game 6, and Game 7. And this dude, again, he's what Simmons wants to call the irrational confidence player. That's Mario Chalmers. Mario thinks he's better than LeBron. But you love that because he's not going to shrivel up under the pressure. He's going to take and he's going to make big shots. That dude, they don't win Game 6 without Mario Chalmers. I mean, LeBron's performance was tremendous, but up until that point, the first 3 quarters, it was Mario Chalmers making shots and keeping Mario Chalmers. He was their leading scorer up until the 4th quarter. So I thought his performance for the series was great. Again, if you can get 1 or 2 good games out of your role players in a 7-game series, you get 1 good game out of your role players in a 7-game series, that's good. 2 is excellent. 3 is just off the charts out, because that's why they call them role players. So those 2 players stood out. What I'm going to be looking back on is just how San Antonio forever will lament blowing this chance, because this series should have been over in 6 games. They had like so many things had to go right for Miami and wrong for San Antonio for them to win that game 6 that was in San Antonio's control. I mean, the only thing that Miami did was they took advantage of the opportunity and Ray Allen made the great shot. But other than that, in that game 6, it was San Antonio's mistakes and, you know, Popovich's coaching that didn't shut that series down. So it was a classic, all-time classic, arguably, I say the greatest series ever that I've seen between that and, again, the 88 Lakers and Pistons series. But this was a classic that they'll be talking about for the next 20, 25 years.
I agree.
Go ahead. All right. I was going to take the go ahead.
I just
as you were talking, I mean, it's just like, that's why, first of all, let me make this clear. By no means am I anywhere near a Miami Heat fan. So please don't take anything I'm going to say or have been saying as I'm a Miami Heat fan. As a matter of fact, the Miami Heat fans are what make me root against Miami.
But
with that being said, why Miami, like listening to you talk and thinking about it, that's why Miami's so must-see TV. It's because it's like I can't remember a team that has been so all or nothing. Either they're winning a championship or the whole team needs to be destroyed and broken apart. It's just like they're tenuring like every single game, every single second is the definition of LeBron's legacy. And so it's just like it's even more so than, you know, the legacy of the Spurs. And I totally agree with Chad when he's saying like to watch Tim Duncan in a loss elevate his legacy was amazing. But just to watch this like balance this like on a tightrope that Miami constantly walks and that you walk with them, where it's like either wow, they're the greatest team, or they should be destroyed. It's just why they're must-see TV. And I think that, you know, we talked about it, you know, joked about it, you know, Indiana-San Antonio series would have been disastrous. And in part of that is because Miami is just such compelling TV because of the all or nothing aspect.
No, they're great. I mean, listen, I love them, I hate them. When they were put together in 2010, they're great. I mean, great for the NBA. Like, they make the NBA 100 times more fascinating, even when they're not playing. Because when they talk, they say so stupid things, and even their actions off the court, and just in comments in general. So they're beautiful in the NBA. They have certainly taken the reins from Kobe and Shaq and that whole drama and the Lakers. So they're beautiful. In terms of just like great publicity, they're great. I mean, they're great too. It's must see TV. It's absolute must see TV.
Chad, yep. Did you want to comment on Popovich?
We can get to the coaching. Go ahead. Get to the coaching on both sides.
Okay. Yeah. I think you guys both probably longer than me on the coaching, but I think we can start with Pop. I'll start with Popovich. I think that he gets a pass. He gets a pass only because he won 4 rings. Because I think, and when I say he gets a pass, I'm not excusing what he did. I mean, he ultimately would get a media pass, whereas I don't think this will be remembered as bad as it should be. This is going to be remembered, and we're going to always talk about Game 6, but I feel like if Popovich didn't have these 4 rings on his resume, he might lose his job. just because there were so many things that just didn't make sense. I mean, if you think about it, this is like deja vu with the Indiana and Miami series when they took Hibbert out twice. Indiana was up, they sent him to overtime with LeBron hitting that. When LeBron hit that shot, it was overtime. LeBron hit that shot the last second when he took Hibbert out. And Vogel, they got into him hard, you know. But the next day, Vogel at least said he made a mistake, you know. Won't do it again. Like, Pop didn't even acknowledge it. You know, there was one person that asked about it. Then they moved on to the next question. Like, the analyst talked about it. But actually, reporters in the news press conference, one person asked, they moved on. You know, and that's all he had to say about it. And I just thought that I was trying to figure out his logic. Like, I got the Tony Parker at times, but then the Tim Duncan thing just didn't make sense. You know, and I'm talking about Game 6. I'm sorry. We're talking about Game 6. Because those rebounds, like even LeBron, like, you know, everyone talks about Ray Allen's three. We forget LeBron hit 3 right before that. He hit the 3. He missed it because he hit the side of the backboard. And they somehow came up with the ball again. He gets it back, then he hits the 3. And it's those offensive rebounds that you say, would they have got him? You know, even Game 7, in a span of 3 minutes, we saw Ginobili turn the ball over 2 big times. So your last possession, Tony Parker's not good enough to run the offense. I know he was out of it, and, you know, the hamstring and all of that, but this is the last possession of the series. And you give it to Ginobili? We've just seen what Ginobili's been doing. And, I mean, it wasn't a big critique, of course, but when you start to put these little things together, this starts to become a pattern. And I think it was one of these situations where, and Pop never does this, but he out-dunked himself.
Yep.
Because we always give him credit for knowing his players. He'll sit Tim Duncan and Tony Parker for quarters if he doesn't feel like they're giving it. And no one questions it because we're like, oh, well, Pop must know. They ain't got no gas in them. And normally what happens, it works. You know, when you think about that Golden State comeback, Tony Parker and Tim Duncan ain't do that. When they beat the Warriors, when the Warriors had that crazy lead, remember Tim Duncan was hurt for a minute and went to the locker room for a second. Those role players brought him back. So Popovich really believes in his system, but I think it was just, he was doing way too much at the wrong time. You know, he let the moment consume him. Like, okay, I'm going to put this in. You need your best players on the floor.
I don't care if Bosh is 0 for 12 or whatever, or Wade or whatever. You got to have your best players on the floor in these crucial moments. And I feel like as much as Game 6 will haunt the Spurs, it's going to haunt him more. I just don't think the media, and I could be wrong, but I don't think they're going to come down as hard on him as they could because of his. And I rightfully so, because he's earned those stripes, you know. But if this had been a younger coach, if this had been Spoelstra doing those moves. So, and I'll get to Spoelstra real quick, and then you guys got it. Because, you know, Surreal, we went back and forth earlier, and you said, you know, he's an elite up-and-coming coach now. And I had a problem saying that, but I have to, man, because he is now entering, and don't take this statement the wrong way, but Phil Jackson territory in the sense of the argument, well, he has the best players. Because that was my biggest knock on Phil Jackson for years. I hated Phil Jackson. Everyone knows that. It was like, well, he got Jordan. Well, he got Kobe and Shaq. But then when I see other coaches get these players, it's a real skill to coach greatness. There's a real skill to that. And Surreal, you spoke to this earlier this week when I talked to you, but to deal with, I mean, Miami, one thing I hate about Miami, and this is a sidebar, I've never seen so many elite players flop so much. It's like embarrassing. It's embarrassing. And if there was ever, if LeBron wins 20 championships, I'd be like, Kobe and Jordan ain't flop like that. You know, he might be better, but it's just like, oh, come on. And the thing is, it's different when you're a little dude. When you're 6'8", 270, it just don't even look right. It doesn't look right. So Spoelstra deals with all of this chaos, all of this media, all of this, no credit for anything unless it's losing. And the biggest thing about that, when Phil Jackson dealt with it, Phil Jackson dealt with it alone. Like, Spoelstra has the godfather right there. We all know Pat Riley's work. We saw how he was about, Spoelstra's always one elimination from getting Van Gundy. You know, we always waiting for Pat Riley to come down and step, you know, on his toes and just get another ring for himself as a coach. But Spoelstra came up to the moment, man. He doesn't ever lose his composure. And I think that it's just a great fit for what they're doing there. So I have to really tip my hat off to him, man. I think he played to the moment. And the only other thing I'll say is this is when you start calling coaches great and brilliant. I know we use the word brilliant too loosely, and I'm going to give you an example of when we use it too loosely. And I always find a way to go back here. But calling D'Antoni a brilliant coaching mind, because, you know, 7 seconds or less and all this, and I'm like, someone answer this one question for me. Has 7 seconds or less worked? Has it worked? Did they win a championship? Did he get to the finals? No. So for Miami to do this small ball, the worst rebounding team in the league, no center, and to win it 2 times in a row, I really have to give Spoelstra a ton of credit. I wouldn't even know what to do if Miami had a Hibbert or something like that, or a big bruiser and banger that could rebound and block shots with their aggressive style defense. So hats off to Spoelstra, man. It's not too many times that you see coaches who going into the series one so outweighed, but played evenly, if not better. You know, I never see Popovich get outcoached, but I really put that more on him outcoaching himself than Spoelstra doing it. But Spoelstra really stepped up to the moment.
I think there are a couple points that need to be made on the Popovich thing, because I think I absolutely 100% agree with you that Popovich outcoached himself on that final 2 minutes in game six. I think you go with your best five and you take it from there. You said it about the rebounds, you said exactly what I was going to say in terms of if Tim Duncan's in there, do they get one or two of those rebounds? We don't know, but I would rather have seen him in there, and I think Tim Duncan definitely would rather have been in there, And I think if it had to be done again, that Popovich would have Tim Duncan in there. It's just a case of flat out thinking yourself. But as you were talking, I started to think about the end of Game 7, where after the game was over, and kind of the smile Popovich had on his face as he was like hugging the players and going to Spoelstra and like and doing all of that. And I think that smile was there because he, if not outcoached, and it's probably unfair to say he got outcoached, Spoelstra matched him chess move for chess move, which was surprising to me. Because I thought that would be one of the places where the Spurs would have the clear-cut advantage, that Miami would constantly be reacting to San Antonio. But that move that Spoelstra did in putting inserting Mike Miller into the series, I think it was Game 3 or Game 4, I think it's Game 4 where you inserted Mike Miller in there. And completely changed the starting lineup. I mean, you saw Thiago Splitter was useless after that point. Like he was absolutely irrelevant in that series. And again, you know, I keep going back to it, but I find it to be such a critical stat. And as we start talking about like the future, particularly for LeBron James and the Heat, I think this would be a much more prevalent point. But the lineup with Mike Miller, Ray Allen, and Shane Battier out there spreading the floor and having the shooters out there was a brilliant move, and having it in there for some serious crunch time minutes. I mean, in Game 6, I think Wade got back in at the 2 minute around the 2 minute mark, as well as Chris Bosh. A majority of that time in that comeback was with Shane Battier, Mike Miller, and Ray Allen, and LeBron James, and I can't even remember Mario Chalmers. Who we keep forgetting? Mario, yeah, him. Mario Chalmers out there, spreading the floor. But you know that was Spoelstra looking at the lineup, looking at what is the most efficient, and putting his players out there. And so while it's fair to say that that at times, particularly Game 6, it looked like Popovich outcoached himself, or at least was outthought himself, I think it's fair to say consistently among that series, particularly after Game 4, San Antonio was more in reaction mode to what Miami was doing.
I mean, you can say it like this, put it like this, in terms of two coaches. Spoelstra, he had some shaky moments as well, because you talk about Mike Miller. Mike Miller in games 4 and 5 didn't score and had 7 fouls. So that move obviously actually went against them when they inserted Mike Miller in the starting lineup. Yeah, it forced San Antonio to go to a different lineup, but Mike Miller didn't produce, and he didn't do anything in those two games. But that's like a small blip. Spoelstra had some small blips. Popovich had some just outright just head scratches. And Spoelstra didn't have that. Spoelstra didn't hit the big super home runs, but he also didn't strike out. Popovich struck out a couple times. So that's where I look at the coaching. That's where I look at the coaching matchup as far as how this series went. I mean, Popovich, those two moves, in Game 6, and even like in Game 7, like you said, to having Ginobili, who, by the way, had 12 turnovers in the last two games, having him had four turnovers in the fourth quarter. It's not only the turnovers, it's when they came. They came at like the worst possible times of the games in those two games.
Oh, just to interject, go back earlier when he decided to put Splitter and D out on Wade. That woke Wade up.
Oh, yeah,
that was the ultimate show of disrespect came through it yet.
And he knew he messed up because he took split off like 20 seconds later. So that yeah, that game, the game, yeah, I think it was game four. No, game four, it was the splitter was on Wade, and then splitter and DI was on Wade. Splitter starting out on Wade. Like, dude, come on. You can't have that. I mean, I don't care. Wade on one leg, Tiago Splitter can't guard him. Yeah, 7 foot guard, 6 foot, 2 guard. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, he, you know, I think sometimes these, you know, geniuses, they just get crazy. They just do things. They have so much success to a point where it's, you know, they just can't see past their own genius, so to speak. And Popovich did this. This was the first time ever I've seen Popovich do make moves like that had me just scratching my head. Because those are serious costing moves that he made.
And I go back again to, like, at the end of Game 7, like, the smile that Popovich had on his face. I think that's in recognition of, like, we're criticizing the moves that Popovich is doing. And I think the reason why we're like, you know, head-scratching, like, all this stuff, but I think the reason why Popovich was making moves like that was because of the pressure of Miami's talent, right? In every clip, at least that I saw, when they went to the bench and they were, like, listening to Popovich talk, he was saying to his team, we got to do it together. They're amazingly talented. We got to do this as a team. We have to do this as a team. We have to move, you know. And I think, like, the overall thought process of that is that Miami just puts such amazing pressure on you as a team because of their talent and how perfectly you have to play, and then also how perfectly you have to coach, that Popovich at certain points in time, particularly we're looking at, like, in game six, you know, that LeBron James onslaught where it's just like, you know, I'm just trying something to see if I can slow down the tide, or see if I can outthink, you know, what Spoelstra's doing or what the Miami team is presenting. And again, I think that goes back to Miami being able to force the Spurs to react to what they were doing, which you don't see a lot with the Popovich coach team.
No, yeah. no, not at all. I mean, more times than not, San Antonio is going to have the better talent, you know, more times than not. But, you know, this Miami team won 66 games, you know, the 27-game win streak. And when they were in tune, they seemed to be unstoppable at times. So, yeah, I think, you know, I don't give Popovich a pass, not at all. I think he had a bad two games, and they came at the completely wrong time. I think he had a terrible game six and a bad ending to game seven. But particularly game six, when the championship was really on the line with those moves that he did make. Game seven, you can make a case they were down. They were already down by two. You know, they still had to tie the game. But game six, you know, those who haven't dunked off the court, and then even Parker in the overtime, whether he was cramping up or not. I mean, I got to see Tony Parker go back to the locker room. He's cramping up while he's on the bench. Get him on the bicycle or something. I had to see him go back to the locker room. Just like Wade, got to see him back in the locker room getting treatment if he was that injured as far as the cramps goes. So I just thought that he – you know, again, Spoelstra did not strike out. Spoelstra, you know, even his questionable moves were not that big to cost Miami games compared to what Popovich's moves were that helped cost San Antonio games. As always, when a series ends, people talk about legacies of teams, of players. There are three legacies I want to focus on. As obviously we have, I think, LeBron, Duncan, and also Wade as well. Start with LeBron's first. Where is LeBron right now in terms of the pantheon of all time great players in your guys' viewpoints?
Wow. I mean, I don't know where he is in the top 10?
I think he might be 6. I mean, he's close to the top 5 for me. But that's scary in itself. Just thinking about he is in his prime. He's going to be in his prime at least another 3 or 4 years. so I think ultimately, if he doesn't win again, because we can't talk about the what if. He doesn't win again. He's a top 10 player. He's a top. I mean, I've never seen anything like LeBron. And that's the craziest thing for me, is that we really haven't seen anything like LeBron. So the sky is the limit for him. I think, whereas, like Kobe, and I know, and I don't want to go there with you, so we're trying to compare Kobe and LeBron, because Kobe still has 5 rings, so I'm not putting him over Kobe at all. But Kobe has a chance to be considered just as great as Jordan. I think that's the best thing Kobe can do, is be considered equal, 1 and 1A. Whereas LeBron has a chance to be better. Will he reach it? I don't know. But I think he has the chance. That I just think his zenith is a little higher than anybody I've ever seen. And that's just based off of his size and natural ability to guard 5 different positions. And to offensively play about 4 positions. I just think that that's the thing. He's automatically now in the top 10. He has 2 championships. He has, 4 MVPs, 2 finals MVPs, you know, Olympian. He has everything. He beats all of the prerequisites that everyone, the haters, lovers, all can use. He has it all. He has it all. I think the biggest thing that people have on him still is that he's not the killer that Jordan is or Kobe is. He's cut from a different cloth. You know, he found a way to be likable. You know, the media wasn't around in Jordan's age, but if it was, it'd be very interesting to see how he would have lived up to it. Not just the gambling and all the other stuff he did off the court, but the practices, how he made people cry on the court and stuff like that. Like, he wasn't a likable person. And LeBron, besides what he's doing on the court, he is showing that I can get along with my teammates and really have this bond and this type. It's just a different type of winner, you know. And there's still moments where he looks like LeBron, fingernail biting LeBron. You know, he still gives you those moments where he doesn't look sure of himself. You know, with confidence as he could talk, that, you know, we saw it in the Spurs. We saw a lot of questionable body language from him still. And I think that I'm at the point where I believe he is who he is. He's always going to be that. He's never going to have that type of Jordan Kobe swag, like, I got this, we won. You know, he's still always saying, you know, well, we're going to go out there and give it our best, and we'll see. You know, but I do think he has the potential to be better, but he is right there, top 5 or 6 players for me.
Yeah, this is an interesting question right now. This is an interesting question. You know, like, you think about the Mount Rushmore, and you think about Russell, Jordan, Magic, Bird, and then after that, it gets kind of interesting because you're thinking about Kobe. You're thinking about Duncan.
Chamberlain.
So.
Yeah, Chamberlain.
Will West.
Jabbar.
You know,
yeah.
The logo, Jabbar. Like, so I'm not sure I'm ready to go top 10 yet. But he's right there. If not in the top 10, he's right there. I mean, I think as a student of history, like, you know, LeBron James is incredible. I mean, he just is. Just his complete package of skills is probably unmatched in history. And so it becomes, you know, like, what, like, when you think about great players, it's about like who leaves that indelible who leaves that impression on you for the longest. And I think up until this point in time, LeBron James' biggest moments were the negative. His biggest moment was, you know, how he left Cleveland that final game, the Boston series. You know, his ineptness in 2011 against Dallas. Like, last year's championship was nice. It was nice. It was good. It's kind of like a monkey off the back. But, like, now is when people were starting to, like, see where his legacy would lead. And so I think the impression that he left in the final two games of this finals is kind of like that building block in terms of, all right, where does LeBron's legacy go from here? If he never wins another championship, I think it's going to be tough to put him in the top 10. At 10, I don't think he can crack the top 5 if he never wins another championship, because I think you have to put Duncan and Kobe in front of him. You just have to. Right now, he is, and I agree exactly with Chad, his potential is off the charts in terms of where his legacy can go from here. But right now, I would probably place him just at 10, maybe 9 or 8, if I thought about it. So he hasn't cracked my top 5 yet.
I got him in my top 10. I still would put, obviously, Jordan, Russell, Jabbar, Magic, Kobe, Bird. I'm giving one away here. Duncan ahead of him. That's 7 right there. After that, you have like Chamberlain at 8. And after that, I think LeBron comes in at, like you said, at 9 or 10. I mean, I got a frame over Olajuwon because he has 4 MVPs. They both had 2 championships. So, man, he's ahead of Olajuwon, in my opinion. And, you know, there's really no, I mean, I had to put him ahead of West, more championships, Roscoe Robinson, more championships, and more MVPs. So I think he is in the top 10. Without question to me, he's in the top 10, like Ryan said, 9, 10. And I think that is a great place to be at 28.
Yep.
In the top 10 of all players of all time. He doesn't crack the top 5, the top 5 or 6, right? Because you have to be, to me, 3, 4, 5, 6 champions. That's when you get into like another level of championships and more of a totality of a career. Remember, 10 years in, you know, those guys have, you know, 12, 13, 14, 15 years in terms of most of their career. So, you know, he still has a ways to go. Obviously, the potential is there to be Jordan. I think he's too many championships away for me to say that he can pass Jordan. I think 4 is a lot. 4 is a lot of championships to say that he can pass Jordan. Is the potential there to do that? Yes, but it's still 4. That's still a lot of championships away. Because to me, he's going to have to minimum get 6 to be considered better than Jordan, in my opinion, even with the MVPs. Because Jordan did it without, you know, Jordan, you know, he's done these 2 championships. He has Wade and Bosh to a lesser extent. But people are always going to use that. If people are going to use that to get some going to Miami to chase the championship, right, when Jordan didn't do that. People are going to use that against him. Fair enough. Man.
I disagree. I totally disagree on that point. The reason why I disagree is I think the first, like last year, like that's what I said. Like last year was nice. Wade was still playing at a decent level. Bosh was playing at a decent level. But this year, please, no. This was LeBron, and they were completely
they were
rioting his coattails. It's obvious that LeBron James has not had any, like, Pippen, please, come on now. Come on. Like, Pippen is so much more a player than
not so much more. Let me stop. But Pippen's more of a player than Dwayne Wade is at that point in time in terms of being the perfect second piece to the puzzle than what Wade is to LeBron. If LeBron, I mean, no, I don't think that's a defining story at all. And I think more so history will show that LeBron James came to Miami and brought these guys championships. Like talking about legacy, like Dwayne Wade might end up with four championships, but nobody's going to think of Dwayne Wade as a four-time champion because most of those came because of LeBron James.
That's fair. But, people will also say that Pippen's last year with Jordan, Pippen was like Wade was now, which similarly he was because he was hurt that year. In the finals, he was breaking down as well. So, I'm just saying, four is a lot to be away. Yes, he has potential to be better, yes, but four is a lot to weigh. But the bottom line is top 10 at the age of 28, his ceiling, we haven't seen a player at this particular age who at 28, who you could say definitely has a chance to be better. I don't even think when Kobe was 28, I don't think people were saying that because I think at 28, I'm trying to think how many championships he had. He just had the three. He hadn't had the one yet or two yet. So I don't think people thought Kobe was going to win anymore after at 28, considering where the Lakers were at. So right now, yeah, I think he does. He is on a track to possibly being able to reach that level. And I mean, most of his legacy is still unwritten. So most of it is still a lot of it's going to come after what happens now. Can they three-peat? How would they go through the transition of where moving Wade or Bosh along? Which we will answer those questions later. But definitely in my top ten without question, without even discussion. He's definitely in my top ten. I saw somebody say top 15. I'm like, who are the 14 other guys that are better than him in the NBA history? So he definitely cracks top 10. What about Tim Duncan?
Chadwick? Hello?
What about Tim Duncan? Chad?
I'll go. It's like you said, like, Tim Duncan can... I've seen Tim Duncan go from, 2009, 2010, he's really, it might be the end for Tim Duncan. And then to see him go from that into this year, into these final two playoff games, it's just like, I remember watching game six and just thinking, that's what a champion looks like. That's what a champion looks like. Regardless of what's happening, regardless of even the thought process, the plan, I'm going to try to end this right here, right now, and I'm going to raise my level of play, which is remarkable for 16 years in this league, being a big man, the different pounding that he's taken over the years, and being 37 years of age, it's just remarkable and incredible to see that. And he did. He raised his legacy. And I think a huge point that just didn't get played up enough is Tim Duncan was a horrible free throw shooter. The Spurs were consistently in the bottom of the league in free throw shooting, in a big part, because of his shooting. And for him to, like, just, like, to work on his game and to work on a part where he is, like, an 80% free throw shooter in the regular season, and then I think I saw the stat, he was 12 of 13 in free throw shootings in game six and game seven.
He made free throws now. He made big free throws over the course of the game.
I mean, it's just, it's it's remarkable to see someone who can do those things. I mean, he's absolutely cemented his legacy as the best power forward of all time. And you know, like in terms of will to win, like if Tim Duncan was a two guard, you know, and had the ball in his hand and could affect it that way, you know, who knows? But in terms of being a big man and for doing it so long and so consistently, I mean, he's like we said, he's probably sixth overall at worst right now.
Yeah,
that's remarkable. That is just remarkable.
Can I get in here real quick?
Yeah. We're talking about Duncan's legacy. Where would you put Duncan at, Chad?
Yeah. I'm sorry, I had a phone situation. I would, you know, I agree with Rob completely. I think, and as you guys talk too, yes, LeBron is top 10 for me, not 6-7. He does belong in that 9-10 spot because that is Tim Duncan right there, number 5 or 6. I think automatically, and they said this before the series, but there's no one that can argue he's the best power forward ever. He is. There's no argument about
that. And by the way, he's been there for like the last 10 years.
Right. It's been a topic. I'll tell you why it's been there. It's a character thing. He just wasn't – people didn't like him enough, you know. But he's easily the best power forward ever. I think right now, the way they lost and it's so crushing, I don't know if mentally he can play again. But – he can physically play.
He'll be fine. Mentally, he'll be fine.
What I mean by that is not saying that he's crushed, but does he want to go through it, the whole chase again?
His press conference, they asked him if he was coming back. He said, I got a contract for 2 years. So I think that he kind of wiped that away with that just one thing.
Oh, okay. Well, in that case, to answer
he said he's coming back again without question.
Okay. Well, to answer your question completely, I think he's on pace to be in that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar stratosphere, meaning dominating at the age of 38, 40 years old. You know, he was a first-team NBA, all-first-team NBA. You know, still an all-star, still everything at this age. And like Rob's saying, and I think we all really don't understand the weight of it because we haven't been that, but to be a big man, the pounding, the beating that he's taken, still giving you a double-double, still affecting the game offensively and defensively, still growing, as Rob talked about, being a better free-throw shooter now. He's just clutch, and look, if they decided to change the award to Tim Duncan instead of Bill Russell, like, because he is a champion. He's a champion. When you think about the Spurs, you'll think about Tim Duncan. Every championship he won, he was the best player. You know, he had David Robinson. But the first couple,
he was the best player.
He was always the best player. Had he won this once, he would have been undefeated, you know, in the finals, like Jordan.
Yeah.
So Tim Duncan is easily, and this was hard for me because I'm such a Kobe fan, and I was like, you know, Kobe clearly, I'm just thinking about Kobe and Jordan and all of that. You know, it's really debatable who is the best player of our generation with Tim Duncan and Kobe. You know, because he has 4, Kobe has 5. I'm still going with Kobe. Don't get it wrong. I'm still going with Kobe. But I honestly, and maybe this is me being enamored by Kobe, I wasn't even thinking about Tim Duncan. I was just thinking Kobe.
Right.
I was just thinking Kobe the whole time. Or Tim Duncan wasn't even in my atmosphere. You know what I mean? Like not because I didn't think he was a great player, but I was just like, no, this is Kobe. It's simple. But watching him now, I think the person that this hurts most is Shaq. automatically not Shaq.
He's above Shaq. Yes, clearly.
A few notches. Because
yes.
I'm always going to
say a few notches, but I put him ahead. I'm not going to say Shaq still has 4 championships and Shaq still
This is the only reason I say it. Because to all these kids, you know, whether you're playing sports, whatever you're doing, Tim Duncan, besides being a champion,
he defines what hard work and dedication gets you. And that's why I knocked Shaq down a couple of notches. Character issues I'm talking about. If Shaq had, as we always talk about, because we got to do this, we got to be fair. We always use to knock on LeBron. If LeBron had Jordan's DNA and that killer in him, he'd be a monster. We always say that. So I'm going to go ahead and do it for Shaq for a minute. If Shaq had Tim Duncan's work ethic,
oh, my God.
He'd have 10 championships.
He'd be
right,
Bill Russell.
Right.
He'd be Bill Russell. He'd have at least six.
Yes.
So that's the only reason I say, and I noticed, like, why the hell, let's get a Shaq conversation. I just, when I think of the two best big men at the time, in this battle,
no, it was
all of those.
Duncan and Shaq. It was Duncan and Shaq.
That's all it was. It was all about Duncan and Shaq. And now it's like, that's funny to hear about Duncan and Shaq. You know what I mean? That's when you see Shaq on TNT. You don't even know they played the same era. When you think about how Shaq went out. And I'm not saying, look, Shaq's dominant. And, you know, he has four championships.
Right.
And we never see anything like him. But we talk about not, and this is why that the caveat with LeBron was potential, what he could be.
Right.
No one said he's going to be this. So who knows? You know, who maybe these two, he'll be cool or whatever. But Tim Duncan, I'll say this and I'm done. And me and Rob talked about it the other night. Tim Duncan, Jordan, Kobe, they just want to win. And it shows because they'll do whatever it takes. They don't, that is their high. Winning is their high. That's what they're addicted to. You know.
And what you're saying about Tim Duncan as well, about here's a guy who already had four championships in the elder stages of his career, lost 20 pounds, got himself in the best condition of his life, similar to what, you know, Kobe is doing with, you know, his just continuous workouts. And you're saying, like, how could this dude play at this level at this particular age? That Shaq, we never see Shaq just. That wasn't Shaq. You know, Shaq is retired right now because been retired for like last 3 years because just his body.
Actually, he was he retired when he was playing.
Right, he did. You're right. Yeah. He retired maybe 5 years. Yeah, he was retired exactly. The last 5 years of Shaq's career was irrelevant. So, like, he wasn't relevant. He was not relevant. So, no, yeah, absolutely. Just taking care of his body. And things doing little things like that, and never being hurt, you know, Tim Duncan rarely injured. So those things obviously go into his favor, and just that, you just said, that will to win, and that that will to win, and just how smart of a player he is. You combine all those things, then you have a player, have somebody who's in the top six or seven, without question, of all time, best power forward without question. Of all time. So, no, he actually absolutely raised his legacy even in defeat. How about, you guys almost knocked this before, but how about Dwayne Wade now? I mean, three championships. He does. I mean, he, you know, amongst not all time greats, but that's amongst two guards. Let's see, because he's not one of the greatest players of all time. I mean, he's probably in the top 25 or something like that.
Oh, he's top 25.
Something like that. But amongst two guards.
I don't know about the top 25. I have to think about that one a little bit. Really quick, I do want to say, just to put a pin in the Shaq Duncan argument, I find it interesting when we were going and we were talking about LeBron legacy, you know, we were thinking about people who had more championships and were, you know, extremely talented. None of us mentioned Shaq in the top 10. None of us did.
Yeah.
So I find that, in terms of how we're thinking about Shaq, I find that very, very interesting. I didn't even think about him. It just didn't even come to my mind.
That's a fair point.
In that conversation. All right, so Wade. All right, so what do I think about Wade? I think Wade, like, I think Wade is a fantastic
Hall of Famer.
Wade, yes, his legacy is set.
you know, he's an icon in Miami. You know, he was instrumental in getting LeBron James to Miami, which then in turn helped him to get two more championships. So he's going to have championships on his resume. You know, he has the one legendary finals, which was, you know, it just stands amongst its own. And again, I think that points out to when you're talking about legacy, you're talking about remembering players, you're talking about like how, what image they left in your mind. And it's like he has been eating off of that finals for a very, very long time. We've been eating off of that finals for a very long time. And so I think in terms of two guard, well, we have Michael, we have Kobe,
West.
And then you probably have to put Wade, like right there. I mean, top. He's 4 or 5 on the shooting guard.
Yeah, he's top 5.
Big O. The point guard.
What about Gervin?
Oh, yeah, he was.
Gervin's two guard. He's better. I had to put him over Gervin, though. I mean, like,
Dr. J be considered a 3 or 2?
Now, that's a fair question. That is a good question. So,
Jay's 2, Jay's definitely ahead of Wade.
Either way, with all of this, as you can see, he's definitely top 2 guard ever. I want to say this one thing about Wade. Well, 2 things. Van Gundy pointed this out very early on in the playoffs. And I think it's something that, you know, once again, the young players have to take into consideration. He said the biggest problem with Dwayne Wade is that he never prepared for the second half of his career.
Yes.
When you played that basketball, the style he plays, Derrick Rose, Allen Iverson made it famous. You take that type of abuse. And Jordan and Kobe, eventually you got to get a jump shot. Wade never was prepared for that. So we can talk about his knees all we want, but can we talk about how uncomfortable he is shooting a jump shot? He doesn't want to shoot.
No, he doesn't.
He doesn't want to ever shoot.
He reluctantly shoots.
And I think if one of the things is the, and then I'm done. I think the image that, in my mind, about Dwayne Wade, and which why I get very irked thinking about him in top anything conversations, is like I have never seen a player who complains as much as him and who will – everybody will be racing up the court, and Dwayne Wade is back there just looking aghast at the referee, and it happens time and time and time and time and time and time again. It's so personally annoying to me to see that over and over again. It just, I don't know, it just irks me the wrong way. But, you know, 3 championships that he has.
It is, but it's also, to your point, that he has perfected false humility. Wait for someone to say, look what you did to get LeBron come over here and move out the way. And when his shot is off because he has no accountability, he goes and rips the coach in a passive-aggressive way. Well, we need to get some other plays going for maybe me. He throws Bosh in there, too. Myself and Bosh need to be more involved. And I said, listen, when you are a superstar, the coach has nothing to do with your game. And the reason I say that is because you take what shot you want to take. I mean, Spoelstra put him in plenty of positions where he let LeBron rest. And Wade was out there, and he did nothing. So I'm not going to knock him completely because he's very interesting to me because he has a chance to really figure out how his legacy will continue. If he wins another championship, say he can't go to Germany, get his knees fixed, he doesn't get a jump shot, he could easily win 2 more and start looking more like Robert Horry. meaning like just a really glorified role player. He really has a chance if he can't step up to the plate. Now,
Because, see, I always said he's the youngest old man I've ever met in my life. Like, not met, but I've been seeing, witnessed in my life. Like, because he still should be in his prime. But we understand injuries change things. However, I'm not right closing his book because maybe he can't really work out this summer, get himself fixed. So I'm really interested to see what he brings to the table next season. If he comes out, and look, you got LeBron, so it's not like he got to dominate. You know what I mean? You got to average 25-30. If you average 20 playing good defense and, you know, give us more consistency with the game 6 or 7 type stuff, then you're right there. And you continue to move up that two-guard ladder. He's never going to scratch the top 10, but he can continue to move up that two-guard ladder to get closer to Kobe and Jordan. Never touching him, but closer. But it really depends on these next few years for him. I mean, when you're looking at Dwayne Wade and Ginobili and say it's a wash, that's not flattering.
No, that's not flattering at all. Speaking of the future of the particular teams, I'll start with the champs first. And this is a unique position because I don't think I've seen this in a long time where you can make a case that the two-time back-to-back champions need to make a move with one of their top players in order to get better if they can. You have a situation where LeBron's not going anywhere. Of course, Wade, King of Miami, he's not going anywhere. Chris Bosh, as Shaq would have called him, Posh Spice, had no points. And let's put this in perspective. In a game 7, had 0 points. And people was like, well, he only took 5 shots. He had 0 points in a game, making $100 million. That's not good per point, per million. Like, that doesn't add up. And over the course of these playoffs, there were times where it was like, is he on the floor? And he had, and to my knowledge, he had no injuries. So Wade, bad knee, getting older. Bosh, who is LeBron's age, okay, came saying basically 28, 29, prime his career. What do you do? What do you do with Bosh? Because it's definitely I have to think that Pat Riley has to be thinking like, look, let's weigh our options. It's not automatic that all three of those guys are going to be back there for next year, or Bosh, I should say, because the other two are locks to be back. But Bosh, what do you think about the future of Chris Bosh as a Miami Heat player?
Can I start this off? Because I had an interesting, as I was thinking about our conversation today, I had an interesting thought. I think as I was watching the finals, I was thinking, all right, the move to make is to move Chris Bosh. After they won the finals, I'm thinking they definitely, I mean, you've won 2 in a row, you keep the band together, you go for 3. Like, I think that until all the opt-out, you know, and everything starts kicking in, I don't think you make a move this year because you have your system in place, you have players that know, you know, their roles and what to do in those systems. But also, I think one of the reasons you keep Bosh in Miami for this year. Hold on, really quick before I even say this. Does Bosh have the opt out next year?
Yes, he does. Yes. All three of them have opt out next year.
Okay, all right. So shift mind just a little bit. You keep Bosh initially and then you let Bosh tear the league up. Because I think what we're seeing is as LeBron James rises, Dwayne Wade holds on to his spot, number 2. He's not going to let that go. That it's Bosh who initially we all know had to sacrifice his game the most, but now it's just kind of like a de-evolution. Like there's just not a lot for him to do offensively in the offense, other than take the big man away, spread the floor, and then get shoot jump shots, which is what it does. They don't try to post up a lot in the offense. And so, right now, if I was Miami Heat,
as it with Fox coming off a 0 point playoff performance, as you said, I would be concerned about what I could get for a Chris Bosh. So I think you keep Bosh on your team in the beginning, and you try to let it be the Bosh show as much as possible in the early deadline.
Let me stop you right there.
Boost his value, and then you try to flip him.
How do you boost his value, though? How?
This
is
why.
You just say they don't post up. Okay, they don't post up.
Well, hold on. Let me get in here real quick because Rob stole my answer completely, so I'm going to be even quicker. He's going to know. No, I'm saying because you're completely right. You're completely right. This is my biggest notch on Spoelstra. I was like, why are we trying to turn Bosh into Nowitzki 2.0?
Yes.
When they made this man a three-point shooter, that was the worst thing they could have done for him. Because the thing is, he's still in his prime. We forget this man is not without moves. Like in Toronto, that was his thing. You know, so like who said it? I think it was it
Jenna
Kenny
Rose
Smith?
Talking about his jump. Jalen Rose talking about his jumper. Talking about his post game.
Yeah,
not
a jumper, but it was like they said, you know, 20 to 30% of your plays when LeBron's out resting even. Put Bosh in the post. Put him in the post because I think right now his value as far as a superstar talent couldn't be lower. However, with that said, to you, Surreal, even if you can't boost his talent, Miami smart enough to know that they don't need equal talent back for Bosh. What Miami needs to really consider is what is the talent that LeBron needs around him.
Yeah.
Meaning, if you get a rebounder, a bruise, like I'm talking about, you give me Reggie Evans from the Nets and a couple of draft picks. Like, they can get the right deal. Now, of course, the money doesn't add up, so that wouldn't work. But I'm just talking about if you get like a blue collar package for Chris Bosh, if you get Big Baby and Aaron Afalo from Orlando for Chris Bosh. You know what I mean? Like, it can really work out to their benefit. But seeing that, you know, he had one or two good games, like, his games, his what we're calling good games now are role-player good games.
Yes.
You know, he had 12 and 10. Bosh went off. He had three blocks and 8 points. So he's just a role-player.
He's a glorified
role-player. Let's talk. Yeah, like, you know, forget the big three. This is all about LeBron, what Wade's going to give you. Really, it's just about LeBron and who he's around him with. That's all it's about. You know, Wade's going to be there. You can't get rid of him. Go ahead.
To jump back in, it's like, and that's like, I was looking at it. It's not Bosh's fault. It really isn't.
No.
It really isn't. The offense, there are no, like, there's just not a lot for Bosh to do. It just really isn't. And like Chad said, he was asked to be that player that spaces away from the basket and can just hit open jumpers like that.
How about
they call for and ask for? They don't ask him to post up. They don't ask him to do. Look, I'm not a huge like Christopher Bosh like fan or anything, but I'm talking about in terms of creating value. His stock is low right now. I think the Miami Heat would be best served to initiate more of the offense for him in the regular season, which we all know. Like, they're not going to win 66 games next year. They're going to be saving it for the playoffs. So they're going to be some – the first part of the regular season won't even matter that much to them.
And ultimately,
you know, so they can afford to, like, let Bosh go off. Bosh is a 20-10 guy. He is that guy. He can still do that. And to have him averaging somewhere around that 20-10, oh, my God, there'll be teams leaping themselves.
Time out.
Uh-oh.
The offense ain't got nothing to do with him not rebounding. That 20-10 guy is gone. Now, he'll give you 20.
That guy might be it. I think that guy is gone because he doesn't try to rebound. That's the one
thing.
He doesn't even attempt to rebound.
This is the biggest reason you get rid of Bosh, and it's not about the big three thing. It's like when you think about Miami and three-peating or just winning again ever, who are they most concerned with?
Chicago,
Indiana.
Well, Indiana, Chicago. Those are two teams.
Those teams are both considerably physical teams, and Bosh disappears. He does not play in those series. He is not suited up at all.
when Chicago and Indiana come to play, that's like kryptonite for Bosh. Because he doesn't want to, like, David West will kill him. You know what I mean? If Miami can find a way to get David West, that'd be ridiculous. I think they really should go after Andrew Bynum, his broke legs. He shouldn't ask for that much money. But you think about
I mean, they're talking about him. Forget about Bynum. They're talking about Greg Oden, possibly. That's when, that's the whole
moment. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, well,
he's like
are,
a bigger, bigger Brandon
I mean, either Roy. One, neither one is low risk, high reward. They're both Bynum
no,
Oden
it is,
and
it
Greg Oden.
It is. It is.
No,
they, I
mean,
both, you know, they
like,
did work
what,
out Eddie Curry.
Excuse me. What is going on in Greg Oden again? What's going on?
Yes.
I'm just confused on that. When was the last time he played?
He hasn't played for a while. It's been 2 years. So he sat out this season. This season he sat out to recuperate for the entire season.
Oh, is that
he
what
did, it
was
he didn't get hurt. He didn't get, yeah, he didn't get hurt this season. He got hurt the previous season. We sat out this season to, like, to recuperate.
And kill him.
I'm over it.
Reward.
Either one, Bynum or Odom, either one. They both low risk, high reward. So they're both like, not paying no money for them. It's whatever.
I mean,
I know what you're saying.
As you know, Terrell, as a Lakers fan, you're all in a similar situation, although Gasol's a lot better. Like, he doesn't fit D'Antoni's system. Like, when you try to make somebody a 20 to 30 you know, 30-foot jump shot shooter, you're going to take away from his game. And I think that's why Gasol's value is lower than it should be. It's lower than it should be because of the system these guys are playing in. You know, so Bosh is not a bum. He is a bum for this system. Unless he gets it in his head to something like, yo, I got to work on this 18 to 20-foot jump shot. And he used to have a really nice jump shot, but he's never going to be just a jump shooter. You know,
yeah,
but
him work 3-point corner shots. That's where they had. They told him to put on 3-point corner shots from the corner.
I mean, so basically, they wanted him to be Shane Battier.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, basically,
right.
A bigger version of Shane Battier. That's I mean, that's basically where they.
I mean, honestly, Pat Riley's so cutthroat. He might amnesty by. I don't know what Pat Riley's going to do. Who knows? If nobody would take him at the end of the day, he might amnesty him. Who knows?
But
that's money.
I heard that they're because they have little flexibility. They have no flexibility with the cap and
right.
the new these things that come in with the collective bargaining agreement. They're talking
as
about
they MVP. Should. They shouldn't have any flexibility.
They shouldn't.
You've got $300 million players.
They're talking about amnesty and Mike
everywhere
Miller.
Else.
They're talking about amnesty and Mike Miller, who's scheduled to make $6.5 million next year. So they're talking about amnesty and him and trying to go out and get some type of bruise or whoever they could for that particular, where they could with that particular money. I would try to pray. I would absolutely put Bosh on the market and see who's interested. I wouldn't give him up for nothing, but I absolutely would try to put him up. Like, first of all, I think standing pat, I don't think they're winning a championship standing pat as is. I think they have to make some type of improvements as far as getting more, inside, you know, a bruiser, or another role player, because, again, LeBron's going to be LeBron, but Wade, a year older, I think you have to kind of look ahead towards that. Even if you massage Wade's minutes to where you treat him like he's Tim Duncan now, 30 minutes and that's it, which I would, by the way, if I were exposure, I think they have to somewhat improve the team a little bit to get past those two bruises they're going to face with Indiana and Chicago in the Eastern Conference. So I think I would try to move Bosh, again, for an inside player and another shooter. Again, they can never have enough shooters considering how they play and go from there. But I wouldn't give them away. But they definitely, like right now, I'm sure Pat Riley's thinking about what he could do with Chris Bosh because that's just how Pat Riley is. So I think that I definitely think they don't need to stand pat with this current squad and think it's going to be good enough to try to win a championship, even though, because, you know, the bottom line is they had to go through 2 7-game series just to get this one. And certainly can make a case that, you know, what could have happened in game 6 with San Antonio. So I think you have to think that way if you're trying to three-peat. And the bottom line is, as well, is from a physical standpoint, it's hard to get back to 4 finals in a row, just from a physical standpoint, with the games being played. And it hasn't been done since the Celtics did in the 80s. Even the Lakers, the Bulls never had a chance to do it. But the Celtics did it. The Lakers never did it when they tried to three-peat. Houston Rockets, all those teams, the Pistons, never did 3 straight as far as getting back to the finals. So Yeah, we'll see what happens with that. What about the Spurs moving forward?
I think the Spurs.
Rob, you got this one.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Spurs are going to stand pat. You know, like you said, I think it's just, you know, Duncan's going to be there for two more years. Manu has talked about retiring. I think if he does come back, he's gonna go back to his role on the bench, and I think it might be a more reduced role.
I'm gonna ask you this: should you bring Manu back?
That's the question. I think you should, as far as you got to know what you're getting from him.
Yeah.
I think this Ginobili, he's one of those talents where he's always going to have a
I'm sorry, I didn't provide you with all the information. He's a free agent.
Oh.
So it's not trade.
Okay.
No trade thing, unless you do a sign trade. But
I think that answers your question even easier then. It's even easier to answer. If he wants to come back for the veteran minimum, I'll take him. I'll take Ginobili for the minimum. And the thing is, it's not like he can't play basketball anymore. He can play at a high level for 15 minutes. You know, I think about, like, and I don't want no jokes here, but I think about the Kenyon Martins and the Jason Kidds, how they helped our team out. If you can really define what you're asking from him, like, clearly what they wanted from him was too much, you know. But if you know what his role is, can you know, because it's just because of his basketball IQ alone, but it's more so him, you have to sit him down and he has to have an understanding of what he is and what he can't do, his limitations. I think if Popovich said, look, we'll offer you the minimum, you're playing 15, 20 minutes, you're not the sixth man off the bench, you know, we'll put Gary Neal over you. You'll get spotty minutes, but when your number's called, be ready. And if he can willingly accept that, I take him. I do.
I also think it's pretty obvious the Spurs need a backup point guard. Like, got to take that responsibility off of Ginobili's plate. If you're going to bring, because I agree, if he wants to come back for veterans minimum, that's fine. With the notion of, you know, crazy Ginobili, like, we can't do that anymore. Have to be more disciplined within the offense. But I think also part of that is got to get the ball out of his hands as well. And so they need to find a backup point guard. If getting rid of Ginobili or not signing the veterans minimum helps them to be able to accomplish that goal, then I think that's the goal that they need to go. That's the way that they go in.
And the one thing I would add to that, Cyril, as you talked about all the what ifs, San Antonio needs to realize Russell Westbrook wasn't playing. So OKC is coming back, and Golden State Warriors getting better. So, and they have these dominant guards over there. So to Rob's point about they need a backup point guard, they just need help with their perimeter defense anyway. Like, Leonard is going to be there, but they need a couple more because they got a lot of small guards. They have a lot of small guards. I think they need to get a little more size and athleticism to match up with some of these younger teams because it's definitely not going to be assumed that they're just going to be back. You know, who knows what OKC does and if the Houston or the Clippers even. We don't know. So it's going to be interesting. But they need to make some moves too.
I would not. I think there's been an overreaction to – what the future of the Spurs saying that this was it. That's the initial thing I call. I said, first of all, the Western Conference is in flux right now. Okay. Yeah, Golden State's nice, but can they take that next step? Question mark. Clippers, they're still the Clippers as far as I'm concerned. I want to see how all these moves, the so-called moves work out, okay, with the Clippers. And they're still the Clippers. OKC, I don't know. They get Westbrook back fine. They were big time with Westbrook, but we didn't even love them with Westbrook and Durant. Were they going to beat the Spurs with Westbrook? I don't know. With no Harden, were they going to beat the Spurs with Westbrook, Durant with no Harden? I don't know.
Remembering that a little bit.
I don't know. I'm just saying. I think the Spurs need to make moves, but as we stand right here on June 22nd, 2013. to me, the Spurs would be the favorites to come out of the Western Conference right now. But that, I mean, that could change with different moves we made. Don't think the Western Memphis, you know, needs to add some things in with their coaching situation. So I don't think, you know, yes, this could have been their best last chance, but it won't be their last chance. So I'll put you from that standpoint. I would get rid of Ginobili. I don't think Ginobili can be that dude that can just play 15 minutes. I would get rid of Ginobili to protect Popovich from himself. I think Popovich has a love affair with Ginobili. I don't think he can help it. I think how you do that is you get rid of him. So you take that out of Popovich's hands to where, no, you're not going to screw up a last second play or last couple of minutes where you have 5, 3, or 4 turnovers. I think that's the player Ginobili is right now. He's, again, people have to realize about Ginobili. Ginobili is 36 years old, okay? He's played 11 years in the NBA, played 6 years of international ball. Ginobili has probably played more basketball than anybody in the NBA right now. Kobe, Duncan, as far as just total games. He doesn't take summers off. He plays for his Argentina national team. So this dude physically is shot. He's shot. Now, can he give you that good game every so often? Those are few and far between. Very few and far between. He was garbage. He was garbage in the regular season and had a couple good games in the playoffs. So I think he's done. I think you take that money that you would pay him. I don't care if it's veterans minimum or whatever, and you go out there and you get somebody to help dunk it out on the front line, and you get that backup point guard that they desperately need because Neal is not a point guard. Danny Green can't dribble. So I definitely think I would get rid of it. I would cut the cord with Ginobili. Kawhi Leonard, you are now our third best player. So you give the young player somewhere, add some confidence to a young player. Those minutes go to the younger players and go from there. So from that standpoint, I would do that. Other than that, I think they're fine. I mean, Duncan comes back next year. Yeah, he'll be a year older, but again, you manage his minutes. Parker, you might want to start, again, with the backup point guard, you're going to start managing his minutes, you know, just to keep him fresh, considering how much you ask of him to in terms of when he's on the floor. So other than, you know, Danny Green, work on your handle. I'll give him the coach's office, you know, you got to work on your handle, period. So they're a young player. They still have a very good nucleus, and the thing they have going for them is Kawhi Leonard. Kawhi Leonard, I generally think, has a chance to be a star in this league. Before the season, during the season, I thought he was like, no, this kid's a very good, you know, he's a good role player, he's a very good one. But after watching the playoffs, I think he has a chance to be an all-star caliber player, and he can take the pressure off Duncan and off Parker in the regular season where he can have 20-point games and carry him with the rebound and carry him to where you can rest those players, so to speak. So he, to me, is an X factor in terms of them moving forward. But I wouldn't go crazy with a whole bunch of moves. I like DL. I like what he did. DeJuan Wagner, they still have, you know, the dude Wagner off the bench. DeJuan Blair. He's a pretty good player. So maybe they're like, look, dude, a couple of years ago you were starting where, you know, you can get your game back. So they still have a nice nucleus of mixture of old and young talent. But again, they have to get a backup point guard. That's a must. They have to get that backup point guard to take the pressure off Parker and to somebody, another ball handler. So, you know, when you get Red Ginobili, or even if you don't get Red Ginobili, you have somebody else that can generate, initiate the offense. But I still think overall that they're in excellent shape, even moving forward. Again, the Western Conference is in flux right now. Again, Oklahoma City would be fine with Westbrook. But again, I had major question marks about them even with Westbrook. Without James Harden, Ibaka, you know, no big man. So they are in Kendrick Perkins, non-factor. So, you know, I mean, we'll see, obviously. I mean, there are going to be some moves to be made. We'll see if Houston gets Dwight Howard, you know, a couple of other moves. I expect Chris Paul to be back with the Clippers. You know, considering that they're going to get Doc Rivers. This Doc Rivers thing is going to happen. It's just a matter of when, I think. Because he can't go back to Boston. There's no way I think Doc Rivers is going back to Boston. So I think he will end up the head coach of the Clippers, because the Clippers know if they get him, then Chris Paul is going to stay. That's why they're pushing so hard for Doc Rivers, because they know that's their key to sign Chris Paul.
And the only thing I had, so I agree with you completely. Now, I know we're not sold on OKC completely,
But with a healthy Westbrook, I absolutely sold on them beating the Spurs. It's about matchups, and OKC really matches up well against the Spurs with the healthy Westbrook. But I mean, to your overall point,
that was with James Harden though. That they beat them with James Harden. James Harden killed the Spurs in that series. Like, I'm not going by what I saw in the regular season this year. Regular season, it was like 2-1. Whatever. I mean, I'm going by what I saw in the playoffs last year with OKC and the Spurs. With James Harden destroyed the Spurs. He was the difference in that series. I mean, Westbrook and Durant did their thing, but James Harden destroyed the outplayed Ginobili and destroyed
the
guards.
Well, this is the thing is, though. Like, Like, you give me a young Kevin Durant in his prime, against the Spurs, I'm going to go with Kevin Durant and Westbrook in their prime. Like, the thing, like Barkley said, and, you know, I'm not one to always quote Barkley, but Father Time is undefeated. 1 year, the analysts will get it right. 1 year, the Spurs will be done. What year, we never know. We don't know. But that year is coming closer than it's not, you know what I mean? Like, so they do have to really prepare. When you said you wouldn't give Ginobili the veteran minimum, I agree in part with you. The thing is, who is going to settle for the veteran's minimum? Because there's a lot of players that would fit that bill, but a lot of people think they're better than they are. You know, there's not too many.
Go ahead.
You said what?
This is what I said about.
No,
I mean, yes, he probably would take. I think Jeremy wants to be a Spur. I don't think it would be a matter of money with him. He wants to retire a Spur. I just don't think you can keep. Like, Ginobili is who he is. When he's on the court, he's going to either make that super great play or one of the dumbest plays that you've ever seen in basketball history. I think, and right now, with his age and with his lack of just athleticism and where he's at right now, you're more likely to see the latter than you are the former.
But you're talking about the Spurs here. I think what I'm trying to get to the point here, and we can agree or disagree with this, but it all comes down to the system. Like, if I'm a younger team, I would never gamble on Ginobili for any amount of minutes. But when I'm the Spurs and he's not in my core anymore, that's an extra X factor, I take it. You know?
Well, my point is Popovich is not going to do that. Popovich is not going to take him out. You know how many times Popovich could have took him out of the games based on how he was performing? Popovich is not going to do that. He's not going to take him out of the games like that. Popovich, he loves Ginobili. That's his dude. Ginobili is Popovich's dude. So I think if you're the general manager, if you're the owner, if you're management, that's where you have to jump in and say, and be like, look, we know Greg loves Manu. We know he's going to play him even if he doesn't play him for, you know, 30 minutes. I mean, because he did play a lot of minutes this year. Ginobili only played 20 to 25 minutes a game this year. But, he played all the key minutes in all the big playoff games and what have you. And you talk about benching Tim Duncan and Tony Parker. He never benched Ginobili. When did you see him bench Ginobili in the series? Think about that. Think about him compared to those two players and how well they played versus how well he played. And he never got benched. Never in this series. That's his dude. Like that. I mean, you can't. There's no. Joey be 50 years old. Poppy should be still playing though. It doesn't like that.
Well,
he loves Ginobili.
But that's the thing, though. Like, you know, they need to write a book about these Ginobili type characters. You look at Vernon Maxwell. You look at the J.R. Smith, the John Starks. These players don't get benched. I don't get it. You know, when the coach loves these crazy knuckleheads, because you know why they don't get benched? Every time they call a player to come in for them, they hit a three or they get a steal or they do something crazy. So I do think, like you said, Ginobili, he wants to retire a Spur. I don't think money at all will be an issue. It's just a matter of if there's something better out there, younger, but still, and you know what, Popovich is definitely king of the D-League player. So if he can get a talent better than Ginobili, that could do what Ginobili could do more consistently, then you're right.
Even if you develop Chris Joseph, who is the backup point guard, even if he develops into where he can run their offense, I'm like, dude, that's what I'm saying. Ginobili being around, Ginobili's just in the way right now at this point. He's in the way of player development.
This is the same team they're still signed Tracy McGrady. So,
yeah.
I mean,
that, I mean, the Tracy McGrady thing was more I didn't understand that. It didn't help or hurt. So that, it was just a move. Like, I don't know if it was insurance for whatever. We didn't have enough garbage time players. I don't know what. If we're down by 30 or up by 30, who's going to play in the game? Maybe they ran out of those players.
Right.
I don't know what the McGrady or McGrady, maybe we do want you to get a ring. I don't know. For your critics and haters. That's one of the most under talked about storylines in the playoffs. Why would Tracy McGrady sign with the Spurs?
I think it was a Nick move. I think Popovich, all this year's playing,
but that's a Nick.
Always wanted McGrady.
Spurs.
I think he always wanted McGrady. He's like, you know what? I don't care. He's 50 years old. I'm getting my McGrady. And that's what happened.
People were actually talking about Tracy McGrady, like, where if he gets a ring? I'm like, who cares?
So let me ask you real quick, right now, with so much going on in the NBA, our possibility of so much going on, and you saying right now you don't believe in OKC, do you have the Spurs as the favorite coming out the West?
I mean, again, it's very early considering, like, we haven't seen the moves. But, right. I mean, right now I have to give them they have to be the slight favorites coming out right now. I mean, OKC, we know, has the most talent, per se. They have the two best players in the Western Conference, two of the top six or seven players in the league. I understand that. But to me, I have to see them – again, I have to see the whole Westbrook-Durant thing, how that plays out. I have to see what Ibaka – you know, what do they do with Kendrick Perkins? Like, I didn't like, even before the Westbrook injury, to me, OKC had some major issues, and they were just getting by on talent. You know, and I thought that a healthy San Antonio team, because I didn't know whether or not Duncan and Parker could hold up to the Western Conference Finals, but I thought a healthy San Antonio team would have beat OKC even with Westbrook. That was just my opinion.
Right.
I need to come in here on this because I could not disagree anymore with what you're saying. And we debated this a lot privately. I think the injury to Westbrook was a defining moment in the Oklahoma City franchise. And the reason I say that is because I think that you realize, and definitely I realize, how valuable Westbrook is to that team. Westbrook is, I'm going out on a limb. He's a stud. He is without a doubt. He puts such relentless pressure on the defense. San Antonio wouldn't have been able to keep up with them. If Westbrook was there, they're going to finals. I think OKC is still the absolute number one favorite coming out of the West with Westbrook back. There's no question in my mind about that.
Okay, I disagree, but okay.
Yeah, I'm with that because it's real. You just say you still got to see this whole Westbrook Durant thing. What you got to see? I don't get what we're looking for with them. They are what they
are. No, the pecking order. I'm talking about in terms of the pecking order. I mean, in terms of who's, can they – the next step for them would be to – in terms of who determine who's actually number one on that team.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I just think that it's kind of like how we kept trying to define LeBron. Their relationship is not going to be defined. It's not. And it's unique because I agree with you wholeheartedly. Everything we've seen, we always go off a blueprint. So something new confuses us. And they don't have a quote-unquote alpha male. They have two alpha males. And it just depends on the night.
That, Chad, here's how I would describe. This is what I saw from Oklahoma City. Durant
initially looked like he wanted the ball more. But as series game after game went on, it looked less likely, or he looked uncomfortable having the ball as much as he did in his hand. I think it's two alpha males defined by talent, because Kevin Durant is more talented than Westbrook, which makes him an alpha male. But in terms of personality, there's no question. Westbrook is the one that makes that whole thing go. And personality-wise, he is the alpha male on that team. And so I think there is room where Kevin Garnett can gladly hand more of the ball responsibilities over to Westbrook in order to get the efficient shot that he loves.
I mean,
I think that's going to be a much smoother process going forward.
So your point is very simple. As long as Durant is happy, the first thing Durant said when he scored like 20-something at the half when the first game Westbrook was out, hey, man, hope you're getting better. We're doing this for you. That's the first thing he said at halftime before he even talked about the game. Like, he missed it a lot.
Yep.
As long as he's happy with their relationship, I don't care what any of us think about what we
see
in basketball. And the funny thing about it, someone brought this up to me the other day. They said as many people got on Westbrook about needing to get Durant the ball more, he won 3 score titles. Like, I mean, it's not like he's not shooting. Okay, Durant is throwing up buckets. But I do think that he does see him. It's just he gives him what he doesn't. He's that aggressive personality that Durant wants to be, but he's not. You know,
yep.
And I think that's why ultimately, it like Rob said, it really defines the organization, because it really shows they complete each other, man. They do need each other to make it work.
Well, they definitely need each other, but I have to see them this year. It's gonna be a big. I mean, it's gonna be a huge year for them. It's gonna be a huge year for them, and Scott Brooks as well. Because I question some of his maneuvers. But I mean, the Western Conference, Oklahoma City is solid there, but the rest of the West is in flux. They're solid. No, we know about Oklahoma City, but I still think the Spurs. My overall point is the Spurs will still be amongst the conversation as far as contenders to come out the West. I don't see them now all of a sudden just slipping back and becoming 8th seed or 5th seed. So I'm like, yeah,
they will still be next year amongst
the favorites to come out of the Western Conference. You can go back and forth with them, Oklahoma City, but they still will be there.
They're basketball version of the Patriots. They're going to win 50-plus games a year just because they're going to be so well-coached. They're going to execute so well. And in the playoffs, we'll see if a more talented team can beat them, or a team who has their number, kind of like OKC has their number. But they're gonna. You're right. They're gonna be in the mix. They're gonna be in the mix.
No, without question, they're gonna be in the mix. What about thoughts on the Eastern Conference for next year? How do we view Indiana? How do you view Chicago? Go ahead, because we've lost Chad.
Okay. I think that, you know, this is going to be Indiana will go how far Hibbert can take – how far Hibbert can evolve his game, right? I mean, I think Granger's going to do what he does. I think his game is going to evolve.
Paul George.
I worry about them being able to keep West. I think that's pencil, being able to keep David West.
Yeah, they have to keep him.
Yeah, that's a must. So I guess sign David West first. I think Granger's going to continue to develop. But I think it's going to be in terms of where they can go in the playoffs, and if they can get to that championship level, because I think that's where you have to be eyeing the ball. Your Indiana is no longer good enough just to make the playoffs. No, you're in the Eastern Conference Finals. Now you got to be thinking, what is that next step to make that jump? And it's going to be Hibbert's development, meaning the consistency in which he's able to utilize
his post game, his rebounding, and like just being consistently dominant or consistently effective. Chicago, man, it's going to be all about Rose. You took a year off. It's just going to be you took a year off. Now you need to come up, you need to show, and hopefully, you know, we can start to see a little bit more of a consistent Jay with Rose. Hopefully he was using some of this time to work on his jump shot, because that would be very helpful to the maturity of his game. It's going to be all about Rose and what he can do to initiate that offense and get them over that hump.
Yep, so it should be, again, an interesting year in terms of the NBA. Should be, we have a couple things going on in the summertime with as far as this Clipper thing, seeing how that works out. Don't know where Dwight Howard's going to end up. It seems like it's 50-50. If I were to guess right now, I think he's probably end up in Houston, just my own personal opinion. Chris Paul is going to stay. I think that's just a matter of just that he's just pulling the strings here, trying to get Doc Rivers in. You know, what happens after that? I don't know whether Doc Rivers is a package with Garnett and Paul Pierce, or just Doc Rivers, Garnett. Do they try to move Blake for Dwight Howard possibly? So Clippers going to be very fascinating to watch in the summertime as they try to navigate up to the upper echelon of the NBA. But the bottom line is everybody starting next year will still be chasing the Miami Heat and LeBron James. That's going to wrap it up for this latest edition of the Cyril Quinn Review. Thanks to Chad Quinn for joining us. Thanks also to Rob Sapp. I will see you next time.
Absolutely.
So long. All right, sir. Thank you.
Later.